But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to our Citywire studios. I am Nora Zah. Lovely to have with us today William DeGale, co-founder of Blue Box Asset Management, lead portfolio manager of the Blue Box Global Technology Fund. Hi, William.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
William, you previously spent 20 years at BlackRock and covering the technology sector. From 2008 to 2017, you were the sole PM for BlackRock's offshore global technology fund. Mm-hmm. Prior to BlackRock, you served in the British Army. You're also a qualified chartered accountant.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's a long resume.
Yes, a third career. Yeah.
Did I leave anything?
No, that's good. That's good.
All good.
Yep, got it all. Yep.
Fantastic. Yep. Now, we're here today to talk about the $1.5 billion US dollar Blue Box Global Technology Fund. Mm-hmm. We've spoken about it in the past, yep. And it's great to have you here again to talk about a few of the things that's been happening in the technology sector, but also about the fund itself and your strategy. One of the main things that I want to speak about initially about the fund is direct connection.
Yeah.
It seems to be at the heart of your investment philosophy. Can you explain this concept to us and why it's so important?
Yes. So to me, it's a fundamental change in the way that technology operates. And it started getting going about 20 years ago. And it explains why so much is changing so fast in connection with technology or enabled by technology currently. Mm-hmm. And essentially, what I'm suggesting that the change was is that before about 2005, every computer system was essentially a digital creature inside its box, and it didn't understand the analog world that we lived in, so a world of continuous variables. So it needed a human being, typically, with a keyboard to translate an analog problem into a digital question the computer could understand. And the machine would then do something very clever with the results, whatever, and it would produce an output on a printout or on a screen, whatever it is, in a digital format. We humans would read that, and then we would act on the world. So we were the input and output device for the system. We translated analog to digital, then digital to analog, and then we acted. But from around 2005, that began to change because the computer came out of its box and started to interact directly with the real world. So if you think about it, the Internet of Things is a big element of this at the front end. So sensors, analog, mixed-signal semiconductors, these allow the system to know something about the world for itself. It's a very limited aspect that it knows about, but it knows it directly. There's no one with a keyboard putting the information in anymore. And at the other end, the system is no longer just suggesting what we humans might want to do next. It's doing it. So the computer is changing the world in a very small way, potentially, but it's changing the world itself. It's not just relying on us to do it for it. So that's a really fundamental change, because if you think about it, that means the human beings, ourselves, we've taken ourselves out of the loop. We're just supervising the system now. And if you take the human being out of the loop, then processes run millions of times faster, because we were by far the slowest bit of that system. And if processes can all run millions of times faster, then hundreds of times more applications become viable. Things that were simply impossible in 2000 are now just very difficult. And the tech sector is all about very difficult. That's what the sector does. So the reason so much is happening currently is because this single break on technology in every aspect of our lives, our personal lives, business, government, military, healthcare, whatever, in every aspect of our lives, things are suddenly possible that weren't possible before, because removing the human being from the loop just makes them work better, faster, work at all. And each time you have a new application that's enabled by this direct connection of systems to the real world, it may enable a range of further applications. Then each of those can enable further applications again and again and again and again. So you get basically wave after wave, first order, second order, third order effects. And they just wash through the economy. And it takes decades for the really big changes to make their way through the system in technology. And as far as I can see, we are nowhere near the end of this. So at the moment, as far as I can tell, the tech sector appears to be trying to accelerate, but it runs into a sort of 15% annual growth limit. From my point of view as an investor, it's fantastic, because it basically stops everything getting too carried away. And that 15% is really important, but it's hitting that 15% again and again, because the demand for technology is effectively insatiable currently. Businesses have so much they could do, they want to do, but the resources just aren't available for all of them to be done at once. So we keep hitting this 15% growth ceiling for the industry, and that could go on for a very, very long time.
Mm. And is that why, you know, you see many tech investors, you know, they chase the latest sort of trend and hottest companies. And but your approach is different.
Yes.
Why is that?
So what I'm talking about here is basically waves of disruption and excitement and change in the way that businesses do things. One company essentially works out how to completely disrupt an industry, turn it upside down. Then its competitors have to copy it or they'll go out of business, basically. And from then on, that new disruptive application is a cost of doing business for all of them. And the result is that every company in every other sector but technology is having to spend all the money it can on technology, because currently that's how you win, that's how you survive. So every business is having to spend as much as they can on technology. They're spending their excess returns, their profits on technology. But if you don't reinvest your excess returns in your own business, your business doesn't grow. So the growth of the entire equity market is essentially being concentrated in a single sector, in technology, because that's getting all the investment. It's a bit unfair on everybody else, because those disruptors, the ones that are doing all the clever stuff, are almost never the winners. So if you think about it, generative AI at the moment, one of the pretty clear use cases for is in call centers. So in a call center, we're all used to it. You phone the call center up with a problem. The person on the headset takes a call and says, right, thank you for your name. Just hold on a couple of minutes and I'll read your notes. Now, that's a complete waste of 2 minutes for him and for me. If you've got a generative AI system there, potentially the moment my call goes through, suddenly the operator or the call center assistant has three lines, you know, three bullet points summarizing every previous interaction between me and his business. And so they can skip the 2 minutes while I read the record because it's there in front of them summarized. Now, that's a brilliant use case for a call center because it makes the call center more efficient. There are fewer employees, or you can have more employees doing covering more people. It's a much better experience for us because they don't have to sit and wait for 2 minutes. So the disruptor, the one that first does it, has a huge competitive advantage, but it doesn't take very long for the call center next door and the other one and the one down the road all to do exactly the same thing. And that advantage then gets competed away. And all of them return to be cost of capital businesses. So the advantage of that disruption goes to the customers. We get better service, faster, cheaper, whatever it is. But financially, the benefit goes to the suppliers of the technology that make it possible. And it's those enablers, those key technology enablers, that essentially extract all the upside from disruption. And disruptors come and go, come and go, come and go. They do really exciting stuff, but each individual company, it's very seldom they're a good investment because they almost never make any money. They never make a profit before they get disrupted by someone else.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about disruptors, I know that we've spoken about this in the past, and your champagne analogy, which yes. I absolutely love. Okay. And I think it explains perfectly how your fund functions, because looking at your holdings, it's a little bit different, your technology fund. So take me through that first.
Yes. Okay. So the champagne glasses are how I picture the way that we think about the technology sector. So you imagine an old-fashioned flat champagne glass, a coupe, and it's standing on top of four champagne glasses, on top of 9, 16, 25. It's a pyramid, a champagne tower with a single glass at the top. And you take an enormous bottle of champagne and you pour it into the glass on the top. And it overflows and overflows and overflows all the way down until eventually every glass in the tower is filled to the brim with champagne. So that's nothing like the tech sector. The tech sector is exactly the opposite. It's an inverted pyramid of champagne glasses. And at the bottom, it has four glasses. And they're called Lam Research, Applied Materials, Tokyo Electron, and ASML. And they're the companies that make the machines that make the chips. And they support the entire industry. So the layer above them are the chip-making companies. So TSMC, Samsung, Intel, Texas, memory companies, whatever. Above that are chip design companies, fabulous businesses like NVIDIA, AMD, MediaTek, whatever. Above that are hardware companies and networking companies and services companies and software companies. And on the top, you have an enormous layer of thousands and thousands of champagne glasses. And those are the exciting companies that are using it, that are disrupting industries, that are changing the world. So those are the disruptors on the top layer. Now, my competitors, most of the people investing in technology, believe, they're told, that their job is to run around that top layer trying to pick the exciting winners, because those are all the exciting businesses that are up there. And they've got to try and pick the winners. Because next year, someone will come with an enormous bottle of money and pour it into several of those glasses, quite a few of those glasses, of the thousands in the top layer. So those disruptions will get all the funding. And people are trying to work out once which ones are going to take off, which ones are going to get funded, which ones are going to grow. Now, I think that's a bit of a waste of time. First of all, it's very difficult because there are thousands of glasses and very few of them are winners, even in the short run. But secondly, it's a bit pointless because almost every glass in the top layer is broken. Those companies are incapable of making a profit. They cannot hold the champagne. It just falls out and down the pyramid. Or even those that are profitable, and some of those top layers are incredibly profitable, and Google is up there as a disruptor. It's a huge champagne glass. It holds lots and lots of money. But even Google, most of the champagne that's poured in, the revenue, flows out and down the pyramid. Because whatever disruption is exciting and gets the money next year, it will use technology, the middle layers of the pyramid. And whatever disruption it uses will use semiconductors. And whatever semiconductors are used will be manufactured on machinery produced by those four companies at the bottom. So we just sit at the bottom of the pyramid and wait for the champagne to come to us. Because at the top, there is total chaos and uncertainty. And at the bottom, there is as near as you get to certainty in investment. So we have, let's say, 20% of the portfolio in the four companies at the bottom and two very similar businesses. Then we have another 40% in the next two layers, chip makers, chip designers. And we have a bit of hardware, a bit of networking, a bit of software, a bit of services. And we're not really interested in disruptors because most of them never make any money and it's simply too hard. Yeah. But that just gives us a different focus from everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. You have described your investment style as looking a bit boring companies in the past when we had a chat. Mm. That's not very techy. Because, you know, tech managers, they want these shiny companies. And I know you've just explained that to us. But can you expand on that? Can you provide some examples of companies that fit that description? Boring companies, solid companies.
So they're boring because they're essentially doing the same thing they've been doing for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. The reason they're still doing the same thing is because what they're doing is a good business. So why would they go and do something else? So it doesn't mean that every company is doing the same thing it was doing 30 years ago is a good business. It has to be doing something valuable that's becoming increasingly valuable over time and that no one else can do it anything like as well. And if you get those three things together, you've got a fantastic stock because that is basically growth of profits for that company for the foreseeable future. So what we're looking for, essentially, are companies that are profitable today, and we're talking about GAAP profits, so full accounting profit, all the nasty stuff left in. And we want those GAAP earnings per share to be growing in the high teens or better for a very, very long time to come. Because if they do, the stock will outperform. That, in the end, that drives performance. So we're looking for that sort of company. And that sort of company tends to be a bit boring because it's been doing it for a while. Everyone knows about it. It's not the exciting new shiny thing. But the problem is excitement doesn't make you money. Excitement is sort of what you spend money on, not what you make money with. And my job is to try and make money for my investors. So I've got to focus on the stuff which actually collects all the profits and where those profits grow year after year after year. So those four companies at the bottom of the pyramid, Lam Research, Applied Materials, Tokyo Electron, ASML, are fundamentally pretty boring companies. And they're doing the same thing. I find them fascinating, but most people find them quite boring because they're doing the same thing. They're making essentially bigger, shinier versions of the machines that they were making 15, 20 years ago. But those machines are absolutely vital. And within their little niche, there's no one else who can compete with them close on. So there's typically ASML is a complete monopoly. And the other three companies at the bottom all compete with each other in theory. But in reality, they all dominate one niche within their etch, deposition and clean market. And there's normally a number two player which has just enough share in the market to cover their R&D costs, but all the profits are made by the one company that dominates. So Lam Research, for example, essentially dominates elements of the processes which are particularly useful for the memory market. So it has a very high share of its revenue go to memory. Memory's an awful market, to be honest. If you're investing in it, it's far too capital intensive, and that creates cyclicality and low returns. So memory semiconductors, in my view, are too difficult. I'm not going to invest in them in general. But Lam Research, everybody thinks that this is not only a bit of a boring company because it's been doing the same thing for 40 years, but also it supplies the memory market, which is a dreadful market. So therefore, Lam Research must be dreadful as well because it's the equipment company that is most exposed to memory. And that's sort of misunderstanding what's going on because the reason memory is a dreadful business is because it's capital intensive. It's probably the most capital intensive industry in the world. And Lam Research supplies more capital equipment to that market than anybody else does. And that, to me, makes Lam Research the best positioned company in the world. So to me, it's very interesting. But to everyone else, it looks a bit boring because it's not changing.
Now, one company that you haven't mentioned, NVIDIA.
Yes.
Now, everyone knows NVIDIA, so I don't really have to give it a long, you know, sort of introduction. But the company has been phenomenal in terms of driver for US and global returns in recent years. Having a look at the holdings in your fund, you've had it in August, you've had about 3.6%, and that was in the top, I think, in the top 10 sort of thing. But since then, it has come out of your top 10. Why?
So it's been top 15 or so for quite a while. So, you know, you have to publish your top 10, and NVIDIA sometimes is in it and sometimes it's not. And at the moment, it's not. So we've had a weight of between 3 and 4.5% in NVIDIA for several years now. And we bought our position almost exactly five years ago, November 2019. We bought a 3% weight position. And at that point, it was a $160 billion company. We still have essentially a 3% position. I mean, a little bit more, but not much at the moment. And it's now something like $3.4 trillion company. So it's increased in value, the market cap, by a factor of more than 20. And we still have the same position because we don't really care what the benchmark weight is. We don't particularly care what the market cap is for its own sake. There are reasons why a big market cap, you might have a bigger position, but not just because it's got a bigger market cap. So looked at in the long run, NVIDIA is a fantastic stock. It's got a very, very strong long-term outlook. It's very well positioned, very high return. It's right at the center of anything to do with processing lots of data very fast. It's essentially NVIDIA. But it's not the perfect stock. It's higher risk than some of our stocks. So if you think about that inverted pyramid, NVIDIA isn't the bottom layer. It's not in the one from bottom layer. It's in the third layer, the fabulous, the chip design companies. The further you up you go the pyramid, the more uncertainty you have, the more competitive risk you have. Now, NVIDIA at the moment completely dominates its market. Its chips are better than any other AI chips out there for most uses. It has a lead. It's not a massive lead, but it's clearly got a lead of some sort in most uses. But that's not why it's selling. It basically got to sell as much chips as it can make five times over. It's because it controls the CUDA platform, which everybody uses to create the AI systems, and CUDA only works with NVIDIA chips. So if you want to use CUDA, you need to use NVIDIA, and everybody's using CUDA. So until someone can squeeze a competitive chip plausibly into the space marked NVIDIA, NVIDIA essentially has very, very high demand because everybody's trying to build as much AI stuff as they can, and it has completely constrained supply because it can only get a certain number of chips or certain area of silicon from TSMC, its foundry supplier. So demand is extremely strong. Supply is extremely constrained. The result is massive pricing power. So essentially, they're charging a huge scarcity premium currently. And just a back of an envelope calculation suggests that about a third of their revenue currently looks to me like pricing power rather than actual underlying growth of the business. And that's great until there's a competitive product. And at the moment, every single company in the whole tech sector, apart from NVIDIA, is trying to work out how to squeeze an AMD chip into an NVIDIA slot, essentially within CUDA, or a Cerebras, or a Tensor processor from Google, or a Microsoft, or all the other potential competitors. And that's an awful lot of people and an awful lot of resources, and lots of them are very, very clever. And one of them will work it out. And when eventually we have a product that is a plausible competitor, it doesn't actually have to take share, but it has to be a plausible competitor, that completely changes the pricing dynamics because then it becomes a competitive market. And NVIDIA has to give a plausible price, not just whatever it wants to charge for the chip. And that will happen at some point. And when it does, margins potentially could fall quite sharply because, as I said, about a third of the revenue currently seems to me to be pricing power rather than volume. So a third of the revenue could disappear, and that'll be a bit of a shock for everyone. Now, it won't necessarily happen this quarter or next quarter or the one after. It may have happened last quarter. So there's a big margin compression in the July quarter, which hasn't been, well, there are lots of explanations. I'm not sure any of them are completely plausible. If we get that again, that would look like the beginning of the end of this chapter of the NVIDIA story. But it's not the end of the NVIDIA story as a whole. It's a great, long, and glorious story that goes a long way into the future. So we'll never sell the position completely, or unlikely to. But at the moment, we keep taking it down to our minimum weight for the stock, which will be 3%. So our average weight for the stock will be 4%. We keep taking it down to 3%. Because I think since we saw the July results, to me, the risk of this stock is rising now. And that's not helping my relative performance this year, but the fund is still up in the high teens annualized, so which is what we basically have been achieving the last 15 years.
Yeah. Well, that takes me to my next point.
Excellent.
About performance. Because I have to say that, you know, your fund has had an impressive track record. You've achieved about between 214, 215 return since its inception, launched in 2018. And, you know, for those 5 years in the Citywire equity sector, you've managed to outdo the majority of your peers. So
hopefully more than the majority. I think it's about 90%.
Yes, it is. It's about there. But over the past 1 year, like you said, your performance has dipped a little bit if we compare it to the benchmark. So Is the fact that you don't have NVIDIA as a big holding?
So, interestingly, if you look at the first 9 months of 2024, at the performance of the 19 active funds that we track, and you plot the performance of those 9 months against the weighted average market cap of their holdings, so how big the average stock is that they own, it's about a 52% correlation. So it's a very high, a really unusually high correlation for dispersion of performance between funds based on a single factor. So essentially, if you're a fund that just tends to have a lot of mega cap positions in your portfolio, you've done better because you probably, apart from the else, got more NVIDIA than anybody else has. If you got really small cap positions, you've had a dreadful year. In relative terms, in absolute terms, you might be doing absolutely fine. And we are towards the bottom of the middle, as it were. So we don't particularly like main caps. We have a few positions, but not necessarily big positions, but we're way underweight our competitors, and especially the benchmark in terms of weighted average market cap. We're still holding our own. Our performance is better than you would expect, given that correlation, and we're above the sort of the trend line. So we're reasonably happy with that. But that puts us, for this calendar year, it's in the second quartile. So we're not in the top quartile for once, we're in the second quartile. But that's sort of perfectly respectable. And if we end the year there, that's fine long term. If NVIDIA does start causing problems, then we will catch up very fast. And in the end, relative performance is how we should be judged on a multi-year basis. If we can't beat the tech benchmark on a multi-year basis, then probably we're not doing a very good job after fees as well. But on any individual year, things come and go, and there's no way we could, the way we run money, there's no way we could have really beaten NVIDIA, because normally you can find there's something better than NVIDIA. You know, Apple in 2012, you must be able to find something that's better than Apple. At the moment, there isn't anything better. So as far as I can see, of the 400-odd tech-related stocks with a market cap of more than $1 billion, currently the only stock that's beaten NVIDIA this year is MicroStrategy. And MicroStrategy is essentially a huge pile of Bitcoin with a very small software company on the side of it. And that would just look so wrong in the portfolio that my investors would get pretty upset if I owned it. So not owning NVIDIA, there's not a lot I can do about it. And in absolute terms, the fund is up, as I said, in the very high teens annualized this year, which is what it's achieved for the 6.5 years since we launched this fund, and for the last 15 years, if you include the BlackRock track record before that. So we've been very consistently mid to high teens annualized net return strategy for 15 years now, and this year is no exception. But the benchmark's gone berserk. And it's because of this single stock NVIDIA.
And I actually wanted to ask you about the mega caps, only because, looking at the fund's fact sheet, you have about 18.6% in mega caps. But obviously, you've gone through it. You've got Microsoft, you've got Amazon, you've got Alphabet. Can you just sort of take us through specific criteria that will lead to including these sort of companies?
Yes. Well, first of all, let's define a mega cap, because everyone gets a bit confused and everyone has their own numbers. I think the simplest way to define a mega cap, and it seems to work for me about right, is it's got a market cap of more than 1% of the S&P 500. So it's a target that moves with the market, and that's currently somewhere in the $400 to $500 billion range. And if you make that the cutoff, you sort of end up with all the right companies on one side of it and all the other companies on the other side of it. So it sort of works and has done for a long time. So I'm defining a mega cap currently as somewhere with a market cap of more than, let's say, $450 billion. There are about 12 of them, 12 to 14 tech-related mega caps in the world. And in general, I don't find them particularly interesting to invest in, because they can't do it again. So if you're a $10 billion company, you're a large cap, by my definition. You've got all the liquidity you can possibly want. You've got lots of information. You're easy to invest in. But if you get it right, you can turn into a mega cap. So that's an increase in value of 45 times or more. And that can happen surprisingly fast in the sector. And it can't happen to the mega caps, because they've already done it and they can't do it again. So to me, the large cap, particularly the $10 to $200 billion market cap range, has all the advantages of large cap investing, liquidity, information, and so on. But it has a potential for huge changes in valuation, which are no longer available to the very biggest companies. The very biggest companies tend to outperform, in my experience, by becoming better businesses. So if Apple just essentially remains the same business as it has since the middle of 2012, it hasn't fundamentally changed. It's still, its entire performance is driven by a single product, the iPhone. There's nothing new that they've created in terms of hardware since then that is material. You know, the watch, possibly. Tags and AirPods, maybe, but I mean, they're not material. They're very sweet, but they're not material. So essentially, it's an iPhone-driven business since 2012. And if you look at its performance against technology, it hasn't really outperformed by very much. I mean, there's some volatility at the beginning, or probably by April. It was pretty much flat relative to tech since 2012.
because it hasn't become a better business. It's just become a bigger version of itself. And in my experience, that's not enough for significant outperformance of tech. It's significant. It's enough to outperform the rest of the market because tech's outperforming by so much. So I'm looking for the very biggest companies that are becoming better businesses. And that's an incredibly high bar because these are the best business models the world has ever seen. You know, how much better can they get? So we tend not to get very excited about the mega caps. And we have positions in Amazon and Alphabet, but they're quite small. They're both sort of 2, 2.5% positions. The only two really big weights we've got in mega caps are Microsoft and TSMC, Taiwan Semi. And in those cases, we just think that the market hasn't quite understood what's going on, how these companies are dominating their specific businesses. So we can justify having a big weight. But even then, you know, the biggest weight we've ever had in a stock, a blue box, I think is 6.5% in Microsoft at the depth of COVID as a, you know, defensive bit of ballast. And in general, we don't have positions much over 5.5%, something of that sort.
Yeah. Any particular company that you will not never hold or invest in?
Yeah, lots and lots of companies. Yeah. the type of company we would never invest in is a business that has no obvious sustainable advantage. So there are lots of very good businesses to work for and run and be the CEO of and that, stuff like that, but aren't necessarily good investments because what they do is essentially execute someone else's intellectual property. And unfortunately, this, for example, most of the Taiwanese technology sector is essentially executing technology, intellectual property that belongs to other companies, which are mainly in the US. So you can get a factory which is doing a really good job on making whatever it is for whichever US company or competing with them or whatever at the moment. But are they going to be better in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? I have no idea. It's very difficult to tell. So you can't just buy this company and watch it go up for the next 15 years, which is what I like doing. So those businesses that lack a long-term sustainable advantage, and that takes out most of the hardware industry, most of the manufacturing companies. There are other areas which look a bit difficult from our point of view. As I said earlier, memory companies, just it's not a particularly value-creative industry. It's because it's so capital-intensive. Other bits would be cybersecurity, where you have obsolescence risk. So it's difficult to buy. If you're confident in a long-term trend for a stock and it's volatile, you should pay more for the volatility. So volatility and risk are completely different. Risk is the story just goes wrong. You know, we don't understand what's going on. It fails. We don't like risk. But volatility, if you believe in the long-term trend, is fantastic because you can trade against it because it's always going a little bit up and down along this amazing trend. So when it's weak, you can add to it. And when it's strong, you trim it. You don't sell it. You don't make it the biggest stock in the portfolio, but you just keep on adding and trimming and adding and trimming. But you can only add if you're confident in the trend. And the problem with cybersecurity stocks is it's very difficult to be confident in the trend because maybe this company is blowing up at the moment because it's been stuffing the channel. It'll all be right in 6 months. That's fine. But maybe there's another product that I haven't heard about, and most of these cybersecurity companies I'm not going to hear about until it's too late, that has just obsoleted that product. And it's not going to recover, so you can't add. So that sort of stock makes me nervous because I can't add on weakness, and that means I'll end up selling it at the very worst moment.
Mm. I know you've touched on semiconductors and semi-equipments because you do have quite a lot in your portfolio, yeah. About 38, you know, just over 30% sort of thing, and then you've got software and services. And that sort of, I know you've spoken about that and you've said it's more of the foundation of your fund, and that is how your strategy will always be. These are the sort of companies that make up your fund?
Yes, I think, I mean, it's not all semis. So we don't own memory. There's big chunks of the semiconductor industry we don't own, but there are certain areas of it which look to us like very strong long-term winners, and we will just vary the weights a bit in the opposite direction to recent relative performance. And they really are the core drivers of the performance of the fund. And going right back to my BlackRock days, the core drivers of my 10 or almost 10 years running the fund there was the semiconductor industry. It's therefore tempting to say, why didn't you just have 70% semiconductors? But if I have 50.1%, then my fund will be reclassified as a semiconductor fund, and it's difficult enough to get people to buy a tech fund, and they'll never buy a semiconductor fund, even though it would be the best performing fund in the world. So we need to keep our semiconductor weights under control to remain a balanced portfolio. It's a broad tech, global technology fund. So our semiconductor total weight is kept, the target weight is kept between 30 and 40%. If they're really doing well, they'll overrun that a bit because it'll be a little while before we trim them back to 40%. But essentially, we keep the target weights between 30 and 40%, and that means we'll never be 50% semiconductors. And then we have hardware, software, services, and a few disruptors. So we have a few disruptors, but only when they've stopped disrupting, essentially. So when they've got to the point when they're harvesting, they've become incredibly profitable. Those profits are still growing in the high teens or better, and they've still got massive barriers to entry, at which point they're not disrupting anymore. They're just making money, at which point we're happy to own them. Mm. But we're not going to own them in the disruptive phase because they probably don't make any money, and the risk is much higher at that point.
Makes sense. Now, I am going to ask you about Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it soared. Today, it soared to around $100,000. And it went down a bit and sort of back and forth since Trump was elected. Yeah. It's not just a fad. And I know that, speaking to lots of people, it's the world's number eight asset with a market cap of about $1.8 trillion. Mm. You're a technology fund manager. You must have an opinion on it. And what do you think of it?
Yes, I think the secret of my hopefully continued success, certainly success today as a tech investor, is I don't particularly like technology. So I don't like all the innovation and disruption. I'm very, very skeptical about it. A lot of it I don't think improves our lives or the world. And Bitcoin, I'm extremely skeptical about. I don't really see that it's making our world better, particularly given the amount of resources that have been poured into it over the last, whatever it is, 12, 15 years. I mean, if you think about the amount of money, effort, computing power, energy, semiconductor supply, that just brain power that's been put into the crypto world over the last decade, and think what that could have achieved if it had been put to productive purposes. And all it's done is created a number that goes up. And if you happen to own the number while it's going up, in theory, you own more money, but not if everybody wants to cash in, at which point it'll go back down again. It is a giant Ponzi scheme. It's very difficult to describe as anything else. That doesn't mean to say it's not going to work. I mean, the US dollar is essentially a giant Ponzi scheme as well, and that's been working for quite a long time. And the question is whether that continues working. And if it doesn't, maybe people are looking for alternatives. And historically, gold has been the alternative. You know, if you get worried about inflation and governments doing silly things and wars and all that sort of stuff, then you put a bit of gold into your portfolio. Then you had gold ETFs, which are a lot more convenient, and all those junior gold miners, which are awful businesses, absolutely dreadful businesses. There was no point in owning them anymore because you could just buy a gold ETF. So then people started investing in the ETF, and the gold miners drifted away from the gold price, which seems to surprise everyone, but that's because they're not good businesses, and you can buy gold in a purer form. And Bitcoin is another version of that. And to me, it's eating into the gold. It's the same role that gold had in the market. It's not something I've never owned gold, and this fund is not going to be exposed to Bitcoin directly. I mean, it's not really in our mandate. It'd be difficult for us to do that unless we bought MicroStrategy, I think. But we are exposed to crypto as a theme because anything crypto uses stuff from our companies, in particular semiconductors and hardware and software and IT services, and et cetera. So if Bitcoin continues to take more and more, you know, investment, success, numbers keep going up, that will benefit our companies because our companies are powering that ecosystem. But we're not directly invested in the Bitcoin price itself. It's a fascinating experiment. I find it very, very interesting, and I follow in great detail what's going on. I just still don't quite see what it's for, given the resources. You can come up with, you know, use cases, but given the resources, I mean, just what could we have done with all that stuff?
Yeah. So that's your secret for success, not liking technology.
I don't like technology.
Looking ahead,
yep.
What are some of the key trends that you're watching in the technology sector, and how are you positioning the fund to capitalize on that?
Yes. So I suppose for our fund's point of view, the biggest risk and which we have to keep an eye on is the stream of disruption slowing down. So direct connection is enabling all these disruptions, and each of them enabled more and more and more and more. When it's not more, but less, then that 15% long-term trend in technology growth potentially slows down. At the moment, demand is way more than 50% a year, and the supply is constrained to 15%, so that's fine. We keep hitting the ceiling. At one day, we'll run out of disruption, it'll slow down, and the whole sector will slow down. I don't think that's going to come for decades, so I think that sees me out, to be honest. So that's the big risk, and I just need to keep an eye on that. Is there enough disruption, excitement, novelty in technology to keep everybody demanding more? Now, within that, then the risks are a lot lower because you've got this fantastic 15% trend growth rate. And anybody who doesn't believe the 15% trend growth rate, just go to your Bloomberg terminal or whatever it is and look at the equal-weighted version of the S&P Technology Index and put it on a log scale and just draw a 15.2% annual growth line, or two of them, because it is perfect. And it only pops out of this line during COVID
3 years of global inflation, and right back down into the line again. Because basically, the industry cannot grow more than 15% a year. So you've got this background of an industry that's capped at 15% annual growth by things like power consumption, manpower, chip supplies, semiconductor equipment, permitting, subsidies, raw materials. All these things stop the industry growing fast than that. However much money Sam Altman or someone else says they're going to invest in tech, there's a limit to how fast the industry can grow. So within that 15% trend, then volatility is fantastic because I'm confident it's going to go back to trend. So what I'm there for is looking for those volatility events. And I think there are going to be two coming up. One of them is when eventually the NVIDIA story comes to the end of this chapter, as discussed earlier, and we get margin compression, revenue will slow down quite dramatically, everyone will panic, the stock will fall like a stone, and people will say two things. First of all, NVIDIA is having a bad time. That means generative AI spend has come to an end. And because generative AI is the only thing people are spending money on in tech because everything else is dead, therefore that's the end of tech. It's another tech bubble collapsing. And tech as a whole will go down, led by NVIDIA, generative AI, and then the rest of tech. That's a complete mistake because NVIDIA will run into problems because there is a competitive chip. And suddenly that $10 billion a quarter NVIDIA tax on the generative AI industry will be eroded away because there's a competitive pressure, pricing pressure. That's fantastic for generative AI spend. It's not good for NVIDIA in the short run. In the long run, it's healthy. But in the short run, it's not good for NVIDIA. It's good for every other player in generative AI because they don't have to pay this NVIDIA tax anymore. So that actually keeps the generative AI story going for longer. So on that dip, we'll be increasing our cyclicality, taking our semiconductors up to maximum because we're pretty confident it will bounce very sharply. It wouldn't hang around. It will bounce very sharply. Then the second one comes along when eventually generative AI slows down. And it has to. One day, this story will slow down. And when it does, again, people will say, well, that's the end of tech. It's a tech bubble at last. It's deflating and popping, all that sort of stuff, because it's the only thing that's growing in tech. And that's misunderstanding why it's the only thing that's growing in tech. And it's this 15% limit. If the whole of the industry is constrained to 15% annual growth, and some of it, generative AI, is growing at hundreds of percent a year, that means the rest of it is growing a lot less than 15%. And it's disappointing again and again and again. Cloud software, it's disappointing because it's an obvious loser in budgets. If your IT manager is being told to spend money on generative AI, he can't spend it on upgrading his cloud system, so therefore he doesn't. But when the generative AI spend slows down and they don't need any more or whatever it is, that money is then available to upgrade the cloud system. So you just get the money sloshing back into all the bits that have been neglected. So the market will plummet because it's apparently the end of tech, but it isn't. It's just a redistribution of resources, which are scarce within tech, to everything else that's been starved. So again, you'll get a sharp drop and then a bounce. So we would increase our cyclicality somewhere near the bottom, hopefully, because we're confident it would then double, essentially.
Yeah. William, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.
As always,
good.
Pleasure having you and speaking to you.
Thank you very much.
But today is VE Day. The war is
over. The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929. The Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.